Hello, my name is Andy Bobick, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with playing snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program, or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to continue reading articles from the August 2026 issue of Mojo Magazine. And if you follow reggae and dub, you're going to love this article, the first article I'm going to read. And then it's an interview with the Water Boys and the making of Fisherman's Blues and a classic album review of Heartbreaker by Ryan Adams. And I begin with the first article titled World of Echo. 50 years ago, reggae's dub revolution hit top gear, opening a Pandora's box of sonic invention. But as David Katz relates from his new book on the phenomenon, 1976 was but one chapter in the genre's fascinating flowering, as Lee Scratch Perry, King Tubby, and more turned the recording studio into a crazy playground. This is a new sound. Ah, madness, this. Portrait by Adrian Boot. On a visit to Lee Scratch Perry's Black Ark Studio in the summer of 1976, Island Records boss Chris Blackwell could barely believe his eyes or his ears. The sounds emanating from the four-track shack adjoining Perry's house in the Kingston suburb of Washington Gardens resembled reggae music, but in a startling, exploded form. Layered cut-ups conjured an eeriness that hearkened to a primordial past. The swampy rhythm, riven by disjointed, echoing voices that assaulted the listener at random intervals with patchy stabs of murmured incoherence, cutting through the speakers momentarily and then fading back into the morass. Spirals of delay worked against the pace of the drums, making much of the work seemed purposefully out of time. And bright horn fanfares were subjected to heavy phasing, adding a distorted treble layer above the deep bass lines that formed the only anchorage. Enveloped in a fog of ganja smoke, Perry was a dervish at the console, perpetually dancing as he pulled the rhythms apart and reassembled them in real time. He was, it transpired, in the act of crafting dub reggae's first concept album, to be titled Super Ape. Here's a song off that Super Ape album titled Zion Blood. I will never work in vain. The eccentric producer's source material was earlier work recorded with singer Max Romeo and DJ Prince Jazzbo. Perry, using his Soundcraft mixing desk and a Roland Space Echo, to reduce the lyrics to garbled fragments that rebounded to infinity, applying filtering tracks to render a dense, hazy swirl. New vocals were laid atop old rhythms, that is, backing tracks, shorn of their original vocals, with prominent brass for a jazzy undercurrent, the ever-present echo giving everything a dreamlike, painterly quality. Blackwell liked what he heard and knew that he could find an audience for it in Britain, but was perplexed by Perry's lackadaisical working methods. The tape was hanging an inch and a half from the reel, Max Romeo told me in 1997. Chris Blackwell walked into the studio and said, "Holy shit, I've never seen anything like this." And Scratch said, "Man, this album is super ape, so it's got to be on a super tape." Super Ape garnered instant classic status when Island released it in August 1976. Richard Williams deemed it required listening in Melody Maker, highlighting Dub's groundbreaking qualities and the dramatic impact it was achieving in Britain. How can I persuade you not to laugh when I say that the technique of Dub may well be the most interesting new abstract concept to appear in modern music since Ornette Coleman undermined the dictatorship of Western harmony almost two decades ago, wrote Williams. It strikes me that there are possibilities inherent in this aberrant form, which could perhaps resonate through other music in the years to come. This may seem wild prophecy, but it could change the nature of some areas and the nature of the ways in which we both play and apprehend music. By the end of 1976, Super Ape would be joined by Garvey's Ghost, a dub version of Burning Spear's Island debut LP, Marcus Garvey, Augustus Pablo's King Tubby Meets Rockers from Uptown, and the Channel One label's Vital Dub album on the turntables of London's hipsters, counterparts to the year's other sonic revolution, punk rock. Dub reggae had arrived. Dub had emerged in Kingston in the early 1970s as an underground phenomenon, furthering the version craze of the late 1960s, which standard vocal singles were issued with an instrumental on the B-side. The practice was inextricably linked to the sound systems that had dominated since the late 1940s, which blasted pre-recorded music through wardrobe-sized speaker boxes at open-air dance events. Since every sound system needed exclusive material to thrive in a notoriously cutthroat realm, central to the tale were the ingenious audio engineers who removed the vocals of previous recordings for one-off acetates, known first as soft wax and later dub plates, making space for resonant toasters to work their spontaneous rhythms at the microphone. From the mid-1960s, to make the most of limited resources, Jamaican producers began reusing master tapes for new instrumentals, and later for toasting records voiced by sound system DJs, kickstarting the process that would gradually lead to dub. Before then, it was monorail recording. Everybody goes on one track, Studio One founder Clement Dodd told me. After I was able to purchase a two-track Ampex in 1964, I had the idea that if I got the music done first, then I could bring in the artist and dub in the voices, which really did work for me because when you're trying to get the musicians and the artists together, there's a lot of stop and go. The idea come that we could use the same rhythms for other music. So the first one I tried was a rhythm by the Wailers, Jailhouse. I used the rhythm and did a song with Roy Richards on harmonica by the name of Green Collie, and man, that really swing. Here's a little bit of that song, Jailhouse, by Bob Marley and the Wailers.
Jailhouse keeps empty, brooding as hell tea. Button sticks get shorter, oh yeah. Brooding gets taller. Can't fight against the youth now, cause it's wrong. Youth are good, brooding. Can't fight against the youth now, cause it's wrong. Youth are good, brooding. Addiction, then Tico Agolin.
Instrumental versions became the rage a few years later, many of which were engineered by Linford Anderson at Dynamic Sounds, a well-equipped studio located in an industrial estate in western Kingston. And some of these recycled rhythms impacted overseas, such as the saxophone instrumental Return of Django, produced by Lee Scratch Perry, and Organ Groove The Liquidator, produced by Harry J, which both hit the British top 10 in the summer of 1969, despite the original vocal releasing failing to chart in either territory. Here's part of the song The Liquidator by Lee Scratch Perry. Perry took things a step further in 1971 when he released an instrumental companion set to the Wailers' Soul Revolution. But these versions simply removed the voices, leaving the backing untouched. Version morphed into dub when engineers began dropping the vocals in and out of the mix and applying reverb, delay, and filtering effects, adding extra textural dimensions. The sonic chasms carved by Dub's protagoners so outre and unprecedented that even its creative figureheads were startled by what they brought forth. Dub has plenty distortion, and it work. Producer Bunny Stryker Lee told me in 2017, people like it because it come up to a new sound. And with the first dub, King Tubby said, this can't work, Stryker. And me say, this is a new sound. Ah, madness this. Known as the dub inventor, King Tubby was dub's figurehead from its inception. His tiny remix studio, located in the front room of his family home in the low-income housing scheme of Waterhouse, Western Kingston, was the most prolific site of dub experimentation in the 1970s. That house was one of the government houses, which was one bedroom, one living room, and Tubby and his brothers helped them mother expand the house, said the singer and producer Roy Cousins, who lived nearby in the late 1960s and early 70s. Tubby was a poor boy who come from nothing and work him way up. Born Osborne Ruddock, Tubby studied electronics at Kingston Technical College and began his career building radios from salvage components. His hometown hi-fi sound system was established by the early 1960s. Tubby, obtaining his early exclusives through the recording studios, whose equipment he serviced, including Treasure Island and Studio One. Bunny Lee often recounted an incident that took place one evening at Treasure Island in 1968 that was a turning point in Dub's development. Ruddy Redwood was cutting an acetate of the Paragons on the beach for exclusive use on his sound system. Engineer Byron Smith left the voice off by mistake, and the wordless version caused a sensation when it was played at a dance, the crowd demanding 20 to 30 replays, according to Lee. Lee encouraged Tubby to try something similar on Tubby's own acetates, giving accented space for DJ U-Roy's toasting and sowing the seeds of future innovation. Here's part of the song On the Beach by the Paragons. Tubby was with me that evening at Duke Reed's studio, Lee recalled, and I come back in the morning and say, Tubbs, you see the joke business up at Duke's studio? You have to do it, you know, and we do it a little cleverer now. We start it with the voice and drop out the voice, and then you bring the voice back in and drop it out again. An organ instrumental titled Ivan Hitler, the Conqueror, produced by Bunny Lee and released in early 1970, was probably the first vinyl release to feature King Tubby's dub experimentation, but only the spoken introduction featured dramatic effects. Here's part of that song, Ivan Hitler, the Conqueror.
I heard of Fatima, I heard of Istanbul, I also heard of the Holy, but I am Ivan Hitler, the Conqueror.
Tubby really came into his own after a series of upgrades at Dynamic Sounds, acquiring their obsolete MCI console with the help of Bunny Lee. The compact board's outstanding feature was an integrated high-pass filter known as the Big Knob, after its round rotary switch, which controlled 10 notched frequency steps from 78Z to 7.5KHZ, sometimes referred to as the squawky, for the effect it could generate when switching between the steps. Its sweeping frequency, enunciation, and subtle audio crunches became defining elements of the dubs mixed at King Tubby Studio, as well as the phasing effects generated by contrasting filtered signals and unfiltered originals. People thought Tubby souped up the board because it sounded different than when it was a dynamic, but he didn't modify it that much, said Tubby's engineer, Philip Smart. He customized a couple of things, but not a major customizing. That squawking sound was always there. That's a filter that's in the console, and them don't know how to use it that way. As 1971 gave way to 1972, various Kingston creatives were venturing into dub territory. A key figure in the process was Augustus Pablo, a rebellious and introspective uptown kid born Horace Swabby, who became a session musician upon dropping out of school after experiencing a series of health issues, including an eye injury, pneumonia, and a botched skin graft. His first claim to fame was a dubby instrumental called Java, produced by Clive Chin at Randy's in downtown Kingston in 1971, whose irresistible melodica melody prefaced the Far East sound Pablo would shortly develop. His self-produced singles had striking dub B-sides too, the early skank version, adapting the Soul Vendors' Swing Easy, allowing the listeners to hear the contribution made by each member of the backing Rhythm Force band in turn. Here's a little bit of the song Java by Augustus Pablo.
East of the Mayako River, to the east of the Mayako River, here's the hottest. Java. Thank you.
Joe Gibbs released a toasting record called More Dub, whose B-side broke the rhythm down to drum, bass, and organ. And over at Studio One, Sylvian Morris mixed evocative dub B-sides for reissues of earlier hits, such as Slim Smith's cover of The Temptations' Born to Love You, Delroy Wilson's rocksteady adaptation of The Temps' Dancing Mood, and The Soul Vendors' Real Rock, proving that dub could help to revitalize perennial favorites. But the song to really prove that dub had arrived in earnest was Marry Up, a disjointed drum and bass instrumental with a fragmented melody that drops down to pure dub halfway through, credited to the Godsons and produced by Glenn Brown. The song was mixed by King Tubby, who opened it with a jarring blast of reverb that ran for 7 seconds. Brown said that Marry Up began as Welcome to My Land, which he voiced with Ken Booth and B.B. Seaton. But another producer wiped the vocals in Brown's absence to sabotage the surefire hit, which is why Marry Up was issued in skeletal dub form. Here's part of that song, Marry Up.
This daughter can't keep up to this rhythm. Ask me no question, I tell no lie. Ask me no question, I play music.
Marry Up entered the Jamaican Top 10 in March 1972, hit the number one position in mid-May, and remained in the charts to late June. Dub was now a tangible subgenre, thoroughly embedded in reggae. The first dub album surfaced in late 1972. Herman Chin Loy's Aquarius Dub, mixed by Carlton Lee, amid for a gimmick-free sound that showcased the musicianship of the new generation band. The dub element provided by the elevation of drum and bass throughout and the up and back fading of guitars and keyboards. Studio One's Dub Store Special, mixed by Sylvian Morris under the alias Dub Specialist, concentrated on raw rhythms, with the bass in pole position and guitar and keyboards drifting up and back, with subtle reverb, selective filtering, and the momentary highlighting of certain frequency bands. The message dubwise, mixed by Carlton Lee, had refined renderings of some of Prince Buster's toughest rhythms, stripped to their drum and bass core, with a smattering of reverb in all the right places, and judicious application of DJ. Java, 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 mixed by Errol Thompson at Randy's, was another early dub album designed with sound systems in mind, as was Joe Gibbs' Dub Serial. Lee Scratch Perry's Upsetters 14 dub Blackboard Jungle was a collaborative work mixed at King Tubby's studio, with Tubby as the engineer and Perry supplying the rhythms and sound effects. Each album was distinctive, despite the limitations of the equipment at the engineer's disposal, the end result ultimately shaped by local sound system demands. We were looking for some different dub sounds because that's when the dub did just come in, said Clive Chin, who produced Java, 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 Java. Herman did Aquarius dub, and then Perry did Blackboard Jungle. But it was them time when good rhythms was under test. When you test them on the sound systems, and there wasn't too many onboard equipments that could do echo and reverb, so we experimented. Despite heralding a new music format, these early dub albums had little impact in Britain at time of release. Most were pressed in minute qualities in Jamaica and almost impossible to find overseas. And although The Message dub-wise was released in the UK on Mellow Discs subsidiary, it failed to break through. Dub would begin to infiltrate British consciousness more successfully from the summer of 1975 when King Tubby meets the Upsetters at the Grassroots of Dub, spent 3 months in Capitol Radio's charts after being championed on the station by DJ Tommy Vance, as well as John Peel on BBC Radio 1. Released by Joe Gibbs' cousin, Winston Edwards, on the fledgling label he ran from a record shop in South London's New Cross, it was marketed as a mixing contest between Tubby and Perry, though Edwards later conceded that the split wasn't necessarily 50-50. 1976 was a watershed year for dub in Britain, since major labels and diasporic independents both stepped up their efforts to help the abstract subgenre reach wider audiences. Island had Super 8, Super Ape, and Garvey's Ghost. Virgin had Channel One's Vital Dub, with superlative mixes of the best tracks on the Mighty Diamond's Right Time. And for those who knew where to find it, there was Augustus Pablo's Magnus Opus, King Tubby's meets Rockers Uptown, released by Clock Tower Records in New York and via Pablo's Yard Music label in Jamaica, mixed by King Tubby shortly before Prince Jammy became the in-house engineer at Tubby's studio, leaving the King to concentrate on his electronics business. The album had unusual stereo panning and detailed spatial placements that saw echo-laden instruments drifting between the speakers. Early pressings were hard to come by in Britain, delaying the album's placement in the British Music Mag. Black Echoes charts until late 1977, by which time dub had fully embraced by punk fans, thanks in part to Don Letts' ceaseless promotion of the form. When I got a job at the Roxy, the first punk rock club, the punk scene was so new that they didn't have punk records to play, so I played hardcore dub reggae, says Letts. I filled the gap with the stuff I liked, and it turned out the punks identified with it. They picked up on the bass lines, and they liked the weed, too. Dub's abstract, untethered format soon helped open-mind practitioners to find more nuanced expression in post-punk, providing atphilistic fuel to the data bent of PIL and Peter Ubu. Dub music and version on those Jamaican dub plates fascinated me because they had nothing to do with accepted structures and formats, Pills Keith Levine told Greg Whitefield. Those dubs sounded so strange, like music from another planet. They sounded like rhythms from an African settlement on Mars. Dub had nothing to do with rock and roll vocabulary, but was dealing with frequencies and sounds that had never been invented before. Dub was a fleeting spectral presence on Pill's first issue and a more prominent underpinning of second edition. Originally Metal Box, bassist Ja Wobble named engineer Mark Lusardi as the unsung hero of the debut LP. And when Wobble went solo, Lusardi engineered parts of his Betrayal and acclaimed Full Circle albums, the latter a collaboration with Hogel Chuske and Jockey Libwitzky of Can. The freshly hatched Killing Joke also benefited from Lusardi's dub treatments. Then Mutumbai's dentist Bovol, a multi-instrumentalist who also ran London's Sufferer sound system, worked on the pop group's debut album, Why, and brought a dub sensibility to the Slits. Cut. Following the series of undercover dub albums he produced at Eve Studios in Brockley that mimicked white-label Jamaican pre-releases. Bovol also gave a helping hand to On You sound founder Adrian Sherwood's first dub productions, cut with the band Creation Rebel, who opened for The Clash in January 1980, with Sherwood at the mixing desk, followed by joint tour dates with The Slits and Don Cherry. While On You act New Age Steppers was a dubby collective with a shifting cast of players recruited from The Slits. Creation Rebel, Pill, the pop group, and like-minded peers. During the 1980s, dub continued to impact a broad range of styles overseas, feeding into the hip-hop, post-punk, and experimental music movements in the USA. New York dance crew ESG, Big Black Steve Albini, and the Beastie Boys were among the many to draw on the obscure techniques of its progenitors. The influence obviously carried on, said Adrian Sherwood, with the movement of people from the Caribbean to England and to the States. It's gone right into hip-hop cultures and contemporary dance music. All the kids making music, they were aware of processed sound, and a lot of that really has got its roots in the old dub masters. Dub waned in its Jamaican homeland after digital dancehall became the prominent reggae style in the mid-1980s, but it continued to impact a wide range of non-reggae forms. In addition to being the defining element of Bristol's trip-hop scene, dub influenced successive waves of electronic dance music, including jungle, drum and bass, grime, drill, and house music. And since the early 1990s, a new wave of British producers have helped fresh variants to make dub a global phenomenon, stimulating underground techno-based scenes in far-flung territories. We used to go to France in the early 90s with a suitcase full of wires to perform UK dub and introduce it to the French people, said Mark Millington of Iration Steppas. titans of contemporary dub techno. Now there's a new generation making what I call Euro dub. They've built sound systems in Mexico, Brazil, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, and in the USA. And they're building sound systems in the UK style because Jamaica has a different form. It's more a clash thing, but this is a love thing. I want to say how important dub music is for other music too, said Tippy I. Grade, one of the present generation's biggest producers of Caribbean dub. He works out of St. Croix in the U.S. Virgin Islands. I don't think hip-hop or any other modern music would sound the way it did without the input of King Tubby and Scientist, these pioneers who created this art form that now inspires people around the world. I'm going to move on to the article where the interview with members of the band The Waterboys, Exalt in Fisherman's Blues. Flush from the big music of 1985's This Is the Sea, Mike Scott hit reset for its follow-up. The road there would be long and winding. As Scott and his raggle toggle accomplices went to ground to dream traditional Celtic forms, country, rock, and more, with intoxicating results. It was free-flowing and open-ended. Recall its principles and other intimates. Something magical was happening. Born in Edinburgh in 1958, Mike Scott was a literary-minded young seeker whose early projects included punk fanzine Jungle Land and Power Poppers, Another Pretty Face. In 1983, he formed the Waterboys, who moved from post-punk to transcendent epic rock over three albums, and stalked their claim to the big time with 1985's sublime anthematic The Hole of the Moon. Rather than pounce on the U2-sized hugeness, which seemed within his grasp, however, and much to the chagrin of his label Ensign, the ornery Scott followed his music to Ireland in 1986. Deep in this new yet ancient milieu, over the next 2 years, lengthy and productive sessions with new and simpatico collaborators produced more than 100 songs, which were ultimately finessed into the Waterboys' 1988 cornerstone, Fisherman's Blues. As Scott prepares to revisit the album and its abundant joy on tour, he gets back to where it started and say how it all went down. Mike Scott, This Is the Sea, 1985, had got the Waterboys' name about. It was our first real taste of success, and my confidence was high. The day after we played the Town and Country Club in London, I moved out of the basement flat I'd been renting at Ladbroke Grove because the landlord was selling. I went back to my mom's in Scotland for Christmas when the tour finished. Then Steve Wickham said, "Why don't you come and live with me for a few weeks?" He had a flat near the canal in Dublin. Steve Wickham. I'd played on This Is the Seas, The Pan Within, Carl Wallinger, Waterboy, 1983-85, then solo with World Party. Had let Mike hear some demos he recorded with Sinead O'Connor, with me playing on them, and recommended me. When I first met Mike, one of the first things he did was give me a spare fiddle string from a fiddle he'd had as a kid. I'd been in bands where songs were written by committee, but Mike was much more focused, a real song maker. We hit it off straight away. Mike, Steve had come to my flat in London, this ragamuffin with dark eyes. I made him Heinz tomato soup, and he told me his life story. When I went to Dublin, Anto, Waterboy since 1983, came too. Steve's poor wife got fed up with the three of us making music at all hours, so I moved to a house belonging to Merlet Avis, who directed the video for The Hole of the Moon. I had so much fun, I decided to stay. Here's part of the song The Hole of the Moon by the Waterboys. Dublin was much less show busy than London. There was a camaraderie and musicians flowed between bands easily. Something magical was happening there in 1986, that energy that flits from place to place. Anthony. Steve seemed continually inspired. The music just flowed out of him, almost without him realizing it. Soon became obvious that Dublin was a whole new world for me and Steve. For me and Mike. Steve knew everyone, all these amazing trad musicians. He also introduced us to B.P. Fallon, who became a friend. Mike. I knew B.P.'s name because he'd been T-Rex's publicist and Led Zeppelin's publicist. He was a walking font of rock and roll lore, fascinating to be around. B.P. was there on day one of the Fisherman's Blues sessions. Enthusing. B.P. Fallon. Mike fell in love with Ireland. It was a new door to walk through. He was always on the mystery train of discovery, trying to get to heaven. Waylon Jennings said, if you want to go to heaven, got a D.I.E. Mike did it and managed to stay this side of the clouds. Pat McCarthy. I'd assisted on a few B-sides for U2's The Unforgettable Fire, but Fisherman's Blues was my big break. Through Purses Dunn was the main engineer initially. Mike had a presence, a focus, and commitment to his craft. You could feel it instantly, his pushing and pushing to land his vision. Mike, I booked the first day at Wyndham Lane without telling Steve, Antu, or the record company. I didn't want anyone reverting to habitual thinking, clock watching, or watching the budget. I got this roadie, Dog Brain, to transport Steve and Anto's gear there without them knowing, and I'd hired a rhythm section that Steve had introduced us to, Trevor Hutchinson and Peter McKinley. Steve, Mike pulled a fast one, and we loved it. It was a long day, in early in the morning, and playing right through the night. Anthony. We got the song Fisherman's Blues that day. What you hear on the album is probably the third take. It fell together in minutes. And here's part of the song Fisherman's Blues by the Waterboys.
Far away from dry land and its bitter memories.
unfortunately, I'm going to have to finish this article next week so we have enough time for the Classic Album Review. The Classic Album Review this week is Heartbreaker by Ryan Adams. Ryan Adams' Heartbreaker was released in the year 2000. Heartbreak and Hard Drink have inspired many great albums, but rarely one as tender as this, Ryan Adams' solo debut. Adams recorded Heartbreaker, a brutally honest chronicle of the highs and lows of love, in the wake of two scarring breakups. In 1999, his much-feted but commercially unsuccessful alt-country outfit, Whiskey Town, imploded in a mess of drink and drugs. Shortly after the collapse of the band, his relationship with long-term girlfriend Amy Lombardi also came crashing down. Adams headed south and locked himself in a Nashville studio for 14 days. With only two rock tracks, Honky Stomp, Opener, To Be Young, Is To Be Sad, and the reverb-soaked Shakedown on 9th Street, Heartbreaker saw Adams cast off the teen angst and small-town flurry of his earlier Whiskey Town work. And here's part of the song, To Be Young, Is To Be Sad, Is To Be High, by Ryan Adams.
Young boy, done me bad, went and did you wrong. Young boy, done me bad, I went and did you wrong. Sad. When you're young, you get sad. When you're young, you get sad. Then you get high. Oh, mate.
With country traditionalist Jillian Welch and partner David Rawlings as his backing band, Adams developed a loose, more heartfelt style of songwriting. Slow-burning acoustic gems like Why Do They Leave and Call Me On Your Way Back Home capture Adams' sense of love, betrayed with a few barely strummed chords and half-muttered phrases. Here's part of the song, Why Do They Leave, by Ryan Adams.
Why do they leave? Oh, why do they leave? On the day that you needed them the most. Simple cards and things, rose-colored sunsets, no flowers for me. Simple cards and things, rose-colored sunsets.
His duet with alt-country royalty Emmylou Harris on the melancholic Traveler's song Oh My Sweet Carolina sees Adams try to grasp an earlier, simpler life. And here's part of that song, Oh, My Sweet Carolina, by Ryan Adams.
Well, I went down to Houston and I stopped in San Antonio. Well, I passed up the station for the bus. Was trying to find me something, but I wasn't sure just what. Man, I ended up with pockets full of dust. So I went on to Cleveland, and I ended up insane. I bought a borrowed suit and learned to dance. And I was spending money.
Heartbreaker transformed Adams into the critic's darling. He was called a visionary rock troubadour by NME, but failed to win over a mass audience. For that, he would have to wait until his next album, Gold. And once again, unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for today. Please join me next week when I continue reading articles from the August 2026 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to finish the article that I started today, but with the short interview with the band The Waterboys. And then an article about 50 years since the birth of the fall, and a classic album review of Bookends by Simon and Garfunkel. Until then, this is Andy Bombeck for Mojo Music saying so long and keep rocking.
Disposition, may you one day hear.